Hello and welcome to the Europeans Podcast, the show that feeds you weekly doses of sweet and sour European treats all via your ear canals.
Delicious.
We're coming to you as usual, using the power of the interweb from Amsterdam and Paris. How is life over there in Paris, Katie?
It's very, very beautiful and sunny. However, everyone in my life has COVID again right now. Feels like it's everywhere. And in the midst of all this, I can only describe my tests as aggressively negative. So the little line where the telltale red COVID line is supposed to be, it's more white than the background. It's like a tan line. What does it mean, Dominic?
That's really strange. If you've got like anti-COVID or something.
Got some kind of new medical condition. If you'd like to study me, get in touch. Hello@europeanspodcast.com.
Mine is definitely not like a tan line. Mine is definitely very much like a red positive line. Again.
Oh dear. He's got it again. How is it this time?
It's worse than the other times, actually, but I'm doing okay, fortunately.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. What have we got coming up on the show this week?
Well, it probably won't have passed many of you by that. Almost exactly 2 weeks ago, Ukraine was granted candidate status by the EU, along with neighbouring country Moldova. It was pretty big news in Europe and was seen as quite a hopeful moment for these two countries. But what exactly does it mean to have this candidate status? And how likely is it that these countries will actually ever become full members of the EU? We're going to be speaking to someone later on in the show who has thought a lot about these questions and about the arguments for and against further EU integration more broadly. Dr. Ilke Teuger will be joining us later to talk about the possible growth of the EU. But first, it's time for...
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
Well, it's arguably been a good week for the 50,000 or so residents of Venice after the city council approved a plan to charge day trippers a fee for entering the city in a bid to curb the number of tourists.
Oh, it's good to see over-tourism correspondent Dominic Kramer back on the show.
Yep, I'm back. And I don't hate tourists. I am sometimes a tourist myself. But yes, I live in Amsterdam, another city that has a bit of an over-tourism problem. But things are particularly bad in Venice, as we've discussed before on this show. It has become particularly difficult and unpleasant to reside in for the people who call it their home. It's not only the general busyness and the mess that's left behind by tens of thousands of daily visitors, but also the fact that most of the city increasingly caters only for the tourists, making the cost of living as a resident extraordinarily high. And by now, most businesses only think about the tourists they serve, not the locals. And you can understand why businesses would make that calculation, because during peak season, tourists outnumber residents 2 to 1.
Wow.
Of course, like most other places in the world, Venice had a period of time when there was relative quiet due to the C word. But numbers have since exploded. Apparently, 158,000 visitors went to Venice on Easter Sunday. So that's more like a 3 to 1 ratio with the residents, which is quite extreme. And I think not so nice for the tourists who are visiting either.
Yeah, as somebody that recently stood in a massive, massive crowd of like 100,000 people at Glastonbury Festival, I was really not prepared for just being in this massive a crowd post-COVID. And it's not actually that fun always as a member. So it does sound like something needs to be done in Venice. They are charging this fee. Like, how much is it? How's this going to work?
Well, from the 16th of January 2023, day trippers will have to pay between 3 and 10 euros to visit the city. The price you will pay depends on the season you're visiting in and how many visitors have booked already.
Okay.
It's meant to work as a disincentive for visitors when the city is already going to be busy, because the day pass will get more expensive as more tickets are sold on particular days.
Okay, that sounds like quite a good way of doing it, like changing the price. I've got a few questions. Journalist Katie is here.
Go for it.
Will there be a limit on the number of total tickets sold? Like, is it possible for them to sell out of places to visit Venice on a particular day?
No, the city authorities were very clear in saying that Venice will remain open. Under this scheme, there will not be a point in which these tickets sell out. They will just get more expensive based on the demand, up to 10 euros a day. Mm-hmm. And they hope that that will be enough to dissuade some people from coming to the city.
And does everybody have to pay this tax?
No, there are actually quite a few exemptions. Naturally, local residents, their family members, but also residents from the surrounding Veneto region. Children under six can enter for free, people coming for work also, and property owners, even if you own your property as a holiday home. Also, disabled people can enter for free. Oh, and people staying the night in Venice don't have to pay the tax. If you're staying in a hotel or rental apartment, you will be paying a lodging tax already, so you don't have to pay the daily fee on top. Hmm. And that brings me to an interesting fact I discovered when reading about this tax. Apparently, 80% of tourists in Venice currently only come for the day. And yet day tourists provide a fraction of the revenue for the city compared to the overnighters. So the idea is that this scheme will do something to change that balance.
But how does it like get policed? Like, do you have to show some sort of proof that you've paid for this tax?
Yeah, just like with everything else these days, you'll get a QR code once you've bought your day pass. And if you arrive at the train station, you will have to show that at the turnstiles. But there'll also be a team of spot checkers who randomly approach tourists asking to see their QR codes. And you're probably going to want to get one, because if you get caught without a QR code, you will be fined between 50 and 300 euros.
Ooh, quite a disincentive then.
Yeah, I think so.
And so what are they going to spend the money on?
Well, at first it will be used to cover the startup costs, but the local finance chief said that he hoped it would eventually go towards footing the cleaning and maintenance bills for the city.
I mean, that does feel right, doesn't it? The idea of like the money going to pay for the impact of over-tourism.
Yeah, I think so too.
Is this like a world first kind of scheme, or is this in place already somewhere else?
Yeah, it's being billed as a world first, and the city authorities are acknowledging that it's a bit of an experiment, so some things might not work out at first, but we'll see. And whilst it's the first city with a scheme like this that's trying to reduce the numbers of tourists in a city, there are other schemes in Italy even that are trying to reduce tourists in areas such as national parks, beaches, or even islands. So it's not totally unheard of.
And I know this is pretty new, but do we have any idea how local people in Venice are responding to this idea?
Yeah, I wanted to know that too. So I got in touch with Elena Riu. Do you remember her? We interviewed her.
Yes.
Yeah, we interviewed her back on the show, The Tourists of Venice, back in September 2019. And I asked Elena what she thought about this policy, and I have to say she's pretty skeptical that it's going to make any difference, or even that it's going to be able to function. She predicted that the policy might fall foul of some laws around freedom of movement and travel. She also cited that the many exemptions, including particularly for the people from the surrounding Veneto region, as one reason why she thinks it won't make much difference. And she's also worried about using a financial charge as a disincentive to travel to Venice. She points out that the public water bus is also going up in price from $7.50 to $9.50. And with these two policies combined, the danger is that Venice becomes a city that is more and more unfriendly to everyone other than those who have lots of money. And she said to me, quote, "A guest treated as a stupid money bag will likely behave even more rudely, feeling they are allowed to do what they want since they pay crazy money and have to plan their stay in advance."
Stupid money bag.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm sure there are different opinions amongst different residents, but if Elena is to go by, maybe it's not such a good week for Venice residents after all. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, we are sticking with the tourism theme for Bad Week. It is a tourism special, and I'm going to give it to Greece and Turkey because of a rather delicate row over the Aegean Sea, this very beautiful stretch of the Mediterranean between the two countries. And I'd just like to state for the record that I have visited both the islands of the Greek Aegean and the Turkish stretch of coastline facing them. They are both lovely. I'm not picking sides.
Good. Okay. So is this a row about territory or who owns the sea or something?
For once, no, or at least not directly. It's more about the word Aegean. And at the heart of it is this Turkish tourism campaign, or really a new term that the Turkish tourism authorities have coined, which is Turk-Aegean. So it's the words Turk and Aegean with no space between them. Turk-Aegean. And the tourism authorities are now encouraging foreign tourists to visit this stretch of the Turkish coast in videos in which you see the words Turk-Aegean, coast of happiness. And then lots of pictures of tourists laughing on the beach, having a lovely time. I have to confess that when I see this word, Turk Aegean, it doesn't really conjure the magic of the sparkling Aegean Sea for me. Like, I don't think it's an especially pretty slogan.
No.
It just looks like two words have been smushed together. And I checked with my Turkish friend, Neslihan, that I'm not missing like a pun in Turkish or something. And I'm not. Thank you, Neslihan, for checking that with me. But for the Greek authorities, this new word, Turk Aegean, they are really mad about it. Because they're interpreting it basically as a Turkish expression of ownership. If you assume that the Turkish Tourism Board has completely innocent intentions here, you could read this Turk Aegean campaign as simply inviting people to, you know, come and visit the part of Turkey that faces the Aegean Sea. But the way that the Greek government sees it, it could be read as an assertion that the wider Aegean Sea is Turkish or should be Turkish. But I was quite surprised to see that some of these tourism promo videos under this Turk Aegean slogan, they've actually been online for a year already. But this row has really only blown up properly in the past week or so. And that is because it now turns out that the Turkish government has successfully trademarked the term Turk Aegean in the EU itself with the EU's Intellectual Property Office. So they've managed to get legal approval to use this term that the Greeks don't like within the EU.
Oh dear, mm-hmm. A portmanteau crisis.
Indeed.
How come Greece didn't complain about this sooner and stop Turkey getting the trademark?
That is currently unclear, but it's pretty embarrassing for the Greek government. Apparently they just didn't realise this was happening, and now it's too late. The Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, was quoted in the Guardian newspaper as saying, some people quite simply didn't do their job well. Ooh. The Greek government is now awkwardly planning legal action to challenge it after the fact, but they're getting loads of criticism from opposition parties for not stopping this before it was approved as a trademark.
I guess I still find it a bit difficult to understand why it's so bad, like why Greece are so upset about this.
I think you have to look at it from the context of beef between Greece and Turkey over the sea going back a really long time. So when you read angry tweets about this, a lot of them, it has to be said, from Greeks of a nationalist bent, although not always, they really feel like the Aegean Sea is culturally and politically Greek. I mean, the name comes from Aegeus, right? The king of Theseus, who was the founder of Athens. Mm. And the islands in the sea, if you look at the map, almost all of these islands, even the ones very, very close to the Turkish coastline, are Greek islands, like Lesvos and Samos. These islands are right up next to Turkey, but they belong to Greece. And as so often with this kind of geography, when you've got countries with a sea border and a deep, deep history of rivalry and conflict, this sea and what happens in it have been a major source of friction between Greece and Turkey over the past half century or so. You know, things like where exactly the sea borders are, who has the right to fish where. There have even been a couple of cases since the 80s where Greece and Turkey have found themselves on the brink of war over the Aegean. Mm. And over the last few years, the stakes have really been upped because there's thought to be a fair amount of oil and gas a bit further away, nearer to Cyprus in the eastern Mediterranean. And loads of countries, including Middle Eastern ones actually, could potentially lay a claim to those resources. But Erdogan, the Turkish president, he in particular really has his eye on these fossil fuels. He's made no secret of that. And Turkey has been exploring for fossil fuels in these waters, much to Greece's annoyance. I mean, the whole thing is probably really pointless anyway, because in a few years, hopefully fossil fuels won't be worth investing in anyway. But that aside, I mean, there's also been loads of tension recently over allegations from Turkey that Greece is building up way too much military firepower on Aegean islands like Lesbos and Chios, very, very near the Turkish coast. And in his speeches, Erdogan, he keeps making references to the Greek-Turkish War 100 years ago, a war that Greece happened to lose. And Erdogan keeps hinting that Greece shouldn't be spoiling for a fight right now. And these are NATO allies that we're talking about. So, I don't know. I mean, it's absolutely not my place to assign more blame to one side than the other in these tensions escalating. I have no wish to unleash an avalanche of angry tweets from either side. But it's actually quite a scary situation. I don't want to give you yet another thing to worry about, but I've been reading some posts by military analysts who suggest that we could be heading for some kind of military confrontation in the Aegean between Greece and Turkey, possibly an accidental confrontation. And it makes me really sad because something I was reminded of while reading about this Turk Aegean row is just how much shared culture and history there is on both sides of this water. This whole region has changed hands so many times in our history. Yes, it's named after Aegeus, who was a Greek, but under the Ottoman Empire, islands like Kos were Ottoman and now they're Greek again. The point being that, you know, there've always been large movements of people and culture crossing the sea. They have loads of things in common, everything from food to music to the amazing ancient Greek architecture that you can find on the Turkish side in places like Ephesus. So yeah, I mean, it's perhaps slightly simplistic for me to finish by saying, can't we all just get along, guys? But I really wish we could all just get along. Because if there's one thing that we really don't need in Europe right now, it is another military confrontation. So work it out, please, Greek and Turkish politicians. And in the meantime, do go and visit all of the Aegean. It's a very lovely place.
Yeah, let's not have the first war started based on a portmanteau.
Please.
Thank you, as ever, to the wonderful listeners who are giving a bit of their hard-earned dosh to the podcast to keep us going. It genuinely moves me when I think about it, about how so many kind people are parting with some of their money to help us keep bringing this show to your ears. There are a number of ways you can support us. Most people give us a monthly donation through the website Patreon. So you can head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and donate from there. But if for any reason you don't want to use Patreon, you can also just make a one-off donation via our website. Head to europeanspodcast.com where you'll see a big yellow button that's resting on Katie's pink-shirted shoulder and says, support us. Yeah.
I kind of want to replace it with a parrot so I look like a pirate.
This week, a special shout out to our latest Patreon supporter, Daniela Schumann. Thanks so much, Daniela.
You will no doubt have seen the news a couple of weeks back that two countries in Eastern Europe have officially become candidates to join the EU. Big congrats go to Ukraine and Moldova. From all of us at this podcast, I'm sure this is the message they were waiting for. But this is a really big moment. It's the biggest step towards growing bigger that the EU has taken in years. And for Ukraine, of course, a country at war, it's a really symbolic moment. There were lots of calls for Ukraine to be granted EU membership in solidarity after the Russian invasion in February. And I guess you could say that this represents a massive screw you to Vladimir Putin, who, after all, supposedly invaded because he didn't want Ukraine to align itself with the West. Now, neither Ukraine nor Moldova is going to join the EU overnight. That much is clear. It could take years of reforms before the EU is satisfied that these countries meet its checklist in terms of how strong and democratic their institutions are, whether the economy is strong enough to be incorporated into the single market without some kind of catastrophe, and all of the EU's existing laws need to get incorporated into national law. So there's a lot to do. But we wanted to zoom out a bit this week and take a look at a bigger question. Is a bigger EU a better EU? İlke Doğuş is a Turkish political scientist. She teaches the geopolitics of Europe at the Universidad Carlos III in Madrid, and she's a fellow at the SWP Research Institute in Berlin. She is a longtime scholar of the very messy process of European integration, and she's someone who ultimately thinks that growing the EU is a good idea. We will be asking her why. We called her up where she's currently staying, funnily enough, on Turkey's Aegean coast.
Joining the EU means a huge amount of change for how a country operates. But what about having candidate status? Is there anything that's going to change already in the relationship between the EU and these two new candidates, Moldova and Ukraine, even if it might be years before they actually join?
I think the candidate status is quite a new state of mind for these countries. I think even if they know they're not going to become members rather soon, I, for example, watched the Ukrainian parliament bringing the EU flag to the parliament, basically with tears. So I can see that very clearly that this is the change of state of mind. I personally think that the candidate status matters a lot, even if the road to membership will take forever.
How far away from being ready do you think Ukraine and Moldova are? And does it matter if they're not ready?
Well, at this moment, we all know that they are quite far. Ukraine is a country at war, and it will definitely need lots of reforms and reconstruction. Because normally, when we are talking about candidate countries, we talk about reforms, right? This time, we are talking about ending a war, which we basically don't know when it will end, reconstruction and reform for getting ready for becoming members all at the same time. It is also quite similar for Moldova. For me, it doesn't even matter at this moment if they are ready. No country was necessarily ready perfectly in the last years when we think about the final rounds of enlargement. The issue is the EU is hopefully ready to rethink its enlargement policy and move ahead with all these countries.
So you say hopefully, and you've argued in the past that enlargement is good for the EU and that it's in the EU's strategic interest to get bigger. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what makes you think that.
I'm an EU scholar. Now, we all know the EU in its current shape and form does not necessarily perfectly function, and there are many issues related to decision-making mechanisms. So when you defend adding more countries to that, it sounds even more crazy, no, isn't it? But the thing is, for me, there is one very clear idea that I keep on underlining. The EU has the necessity to guarantee cooperation and integration in the wider Europe. So the way to do it could be open to discussion, but the need to do it is quite clear for me. And for the last decades, the best foreign policy tool the EU had was the enlargement policy. The EU transformed so many countries in the continent, closed ranks, created a very big internal market, and both deepened and also enlarged the integration process. So I see this as a very successful example of increasing cooperation and integration in the continent.
You mentioned this idea that no country has ever really been ready to join the EU when it joined. What do you say to people who are critical of the more recent enlargements of the EU that saw poorer countries join, maybe countries that still have a pretty serious problem with corruption? Would you still say the EU is better off having got bigger?
One of the key arguments that anti-enlargement people use in general is that the last enlargement waves did not necessarily bring stability and better cooperation to the continent, but kind of internalized various problems. And there is a truth to that. This is why I generally claim that the EU enlargement or the discussions related to enlargement should go hand in hand with reforms in the EU and the rethinking of the EU so that we can kind of secure better relationship in the future. It is clear that there were rather problematic issues related to the countries that have become members of the EU in the last enlargements. I don't want to do naming and shaming, but we are in trouble with Hungary and Poland at the same time. We have issues with Bulgaria. But I say to the people that kind of criticize the idea of further enlargement, they are right. We need to rethink the entire EU and its future when we are talking about EU enlargement or the possibility of EU enlargement.
Our producer Wojciech was just in Georgia reporting a story for us. And when we were chatting about Georgia possibly becoming an EU candidate, he said that there are things that a lot of Georgians he met really wouldn't like about EU membership, like all the red tape. And he also wondered if, with the way the economy is set up, if Georgia joining the EU would just result in loads of Westerners coming in and basically taking over the economy. Do you have any of those concerns yourself about the way that enlargement could potentially adversely affect potential future members?
This is definitely an important concern. But the issue is, right now we have a scenario where we have some countries, they keep on expressing that they want to continue with their accession processes, and the EU is the actor that doesn't let them go. For me, it would be way more fair to advance in their processes, then see if EU membership is the best place they would like to be. This is a question even for the current member states. The current member states that have become in the 20th century and also in the early 21st century may want to like reconsider their membership status, and maybe they would like to change towards an outer layer that does not necessarily oblige them to fulfill all the requirements that a membership status gives them. The clever thing to do, in my opinion, is also in the meantime, create this outer circle. Then the EU will have the capacity to have this honest conversation with these candidate countries, potential candidate countries, and see if in the 21st century they would like to be in inner or outer circles. It is more honest than keeping countries at the gates for years and years without knowing where they are going, while also hampering fruitful collaboration with them.
That is an idea that some people have been talking about quite recently. Most prominently, French President Emmanuel Macron has floated this idea of some kind of parallel European community for EU neighbour states that aren't actually EU members. Is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Actually, since this has come from Emmanuel Macron, this was perceived rather sceptic, you know, because we know he was quite against enlargement for years. But the idea of complementary institutional arrangements, the idea of building outer circles to the European Union, the idea of looking for complementary or alternative ways for guaranteed cooperation and integration is quite convincing for me. 21st century is going to be a tough one for everyone. So if the European Union would like to guarantee cooperation, integration, and even this claim to be a geopolitical player in the region and the world, they all start with getting its act together in the continental level.
Both Dominic and I were teenagers in the UK around the time of the last two enlargements, when the EU grew eastwards by quite a lot, adding countries like Poland and Hungary and Romania, just to name a few. And I remember it as a really horrible time, actually, of anti-immigrant sentiment. There were all of these accusations of Eastern Europeans coming in and stealing jobs. And you can even argue that this anti-immigrant sentiment was something that contributed to Brexit. I was wondering if you think there have been lessons learned from these previous enlargements. Do you think the EU has worked out ways to get bigger in a way that causes less friction?
We haven't discussed enlargement for the last years. Now it's like people were like, shh, don't even mention it. Don't even mention the candidate countries. So I think these are all very valid concerns. And it's understandable that further enlargement requires PR in some member states. But I think one of the most important things related to this Ukrainian example is that enlargement is not about being ready or not, opening chapters and closing, being in this forever, never-ending, long process of legal documents. It is about Europeanness. It is about securing peace and cooperation in the continent. For me, like the Ukrainian application to the EU reminded us all once again, the European Union is the guarantor of peace, security, and stability of the continent. This sounds quite rainbowy and butterfly-y, clearly, but I think it is important for the EU citizens to understand or to see these things that way, and for the decision makers to explain things very openly and honestly to their citizens when it comes to hurdles and costs that will be carried out for these countries to become stable again and to become maybe EU member states in the future again.
You happen to be from a country that has had candidate status for a really, really long time. Turkey applied to join first in 1987, when the EU wasn't even called the EU yet. And it doesn't feel like relations between Turkey and the EU have been great in recent years. Is there any appetite left on either side for this actually happening?
Yes and no. I think there is an important rising anti-Western sentiments in the Turkish society, and various, both public opinion and the leaders in the European Union don't even recognize Turkey as a candidate country anymore. And the accession negotiations are officially frozen since 2018. So when you look from this perspective, there is no appetite. But then there is also yes, because I have seen personally many people defending belonging to Europe very fiercely in Turkey, and also confessing various EU decision makers that EU has the obligation to cooperates, coordinates with Turkey in various policy areas. So they were also aware that, like, even if they kind of ended Turkey's candidacy process in the near future, they need to replace it with a well-functioning institutional framework for securing cooperation. So for me, beyond all these frustration and bad taste in both sides, there's a certain need for finding a way forward in Turkey-EU relations.
We have been mostly talking about enlarging the EU today, but the international body that looks most likely to enlarge in the immediate future is NATO. Turkey lifted their veto at the end of June, meaning that Finland and Sweden have been invited to become full members of this military alliance in the wake of Russia's attack on Ukraine. Do you think that NATO enlargement is more geopolitically important, perhaps, than the enlargement of the EU or not?
For me, this is comparing apples and oranges a bit. For me, they are two very different supranational organizations, and they both have a very different meaning. And I personally care about not only the EU, but also all the other continental institutional arrangements for one simple reason: what might happen in 2024 elections in the US. Not that I want to talk about gloomy and doomy stories or scenarios here, but the thing is, I think that the European Union and all the countries in the European continent have the responsibility to think and rethink about their future in case something Trumpy happens again. So for me, I think they are different organizations and they both have different roles in the world, and the EU and how it enlarges and how it guarantees cooperation in its continent are equally important to redefining NATO's role and NATO enlargement.
Whether you are a Europe nerd like me and Dominic, or just someone who wants to be a bit better informed about how democracy works on this continent, you should follow Ilke on Twitter. She is there at Ilke Toygur, and you'll find a link in the show notes. What have you been enjoying this week?
This week, I finally started watching the new series of the Danish political drama, Borgen, on Netflix.
I can't wait to hear your thoughts about this. I haven't started it yet. Is it good? Is it good?
Well, I've only watched the first episode so far, but from the first episode anyway, I'm not disappointed. I like how it's evolved since Birgitte Nyborg last graced our screens back in 2013. Obviously, the world is quite a different place 9 years on, and the show is reflecting that in the storylines that are being told and the way the characters interact with each other. Birgitte has some pretty difficult political maneuvering to do in the first episode already that feels, frankly, quite terrifyingly realistic, except for the fact that in real life, I'm sure nobody's as good at the politicking as she is. The series, weirdly, is not officially called Borgen Season 4, but called Borgen, : Power and Glory.
Yeah, it looked like a kind of spin-off, but is it not?
Well, I don't really know why they went for that sensational-sounding, spin-off-sounding title, but maybe it'll make sense eventually. And anyway, I'll take it. The Borgen team can't do much wrong in my eyes. So go and watch it and go back to the beginning of Season 1 if you haven't started yet. And if you haven't, I really envy you.
This is going to sound terrible, but I was kind of hoping to get a light case of COVID this week so that I could watch it all from the beginning. But I haven't. I am stubbornly negative, which I'm very grateful for, obviously.
Serves you right. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I'd like to suggest something for our younger listeners this week, and that is a children's book called She Rides Like the Wind. And it's the story of Alfonsina Strada. Do you know who she was?
No.
She was the first woman to participate in the Giro d'Italia cycling race in 1924. And I think she's still the only woman to have ridden in that race. And because it was 1924, it wasn't exactly a great time to be a woman in what was then an extremely male sport. The newspapers called her the devil in the dress. And she had to really, really fight for her right to do what she loved. She grew up really poor. She taught herself to ride a bike. And it's just the story of a woman who wouldn't let anything get in her way, which is a great story for a kid's book, regardless of their gender. It's by Joan Negrescoro, who is a really wonderful illustrator from Barcelona. He has this really, really fun graphical style, this really gorgeous, bright color palette. And it's the perfect book for the child in your life. I picked it up and started reading it around some friends' house the other day. They've been bought it as a gift for their new baby, which is the perfect opportunity to say congratulations to my friends Anna and Michelle. I know Michelle listens to the show sometimes. They have just welcomed a beautiful Euro baby, Dominic, half German, half Italian.
Aww. Welcome to the world, little thing.
Welcome, Filippo. He's not quite old enough to listen to this podcast, but welcome anyway.
He can listen back in 20 years' time.
Still be extremely relevant.
Of course. When we're all living underwater in the west of Europe.
Yay.
I received some really excellent suggestions for happy ending stories this week from our Patreon supporters on the Facebook group. Thank you all. For example, London celebrated its 50th Pride last weekend. Woo-hoo. The EU renewed free roaming access across the EU for another 10 years.
Nice.
And there was a really wonderful story about bees in Italy helping the Carabinieri police fight pollution.
Yeah.
Bizarre, but true, apparently. But in the end, I went with a sexy happy ending for you all this week.
Go on.
Do you know what the sexiest thing in the whole of Europe is? Throwing away your rubbish in a rubbish bin.
Okay.
That's what everyone says. Well, that's if you live in the Swedish city of Malmö anyway, because this city has installed a few new talking bins. And when I say talking, I kind of mean moaning and groaning sexily. They respond when you insert a piece of rubbish in them. And I think it's probably easiest if I just play you a clip of the bin groaning after receiving some rubbish.
Oh, precis där, ja.
That's gross.
Mer. Tack.
If your Swedish isn't up to scratch, then the bin is saying things like, more, and come back quickly and do that again. And my favourite, ooh, right there, yes.
Is this like strictly necessary? I mean, couldn't it have been like a sort of Cookie Monster style, like, me hungry kind of thing? Did they have to go with something so sleazy?
Oh, it's not a bad idea, actually, the Cookie Monster. You should go and work for the Malmö Roads Department.
Maybe I should. Make it family friendly.
Clearly, it's just an attention-grabbing gimmick from the city authorities, but I quite like it. And Marie Persson, who's the section chief at the Malmö Roads Department, said to the Sydsvenskan newspaper that the sexy texts are there to get more people to talk about the dirtiest thing that exists, littering. And to be fair, it does sound like it makes clearing up the litter a little bit more fun.
That's it for this week. Before we go, I am putting together a little European summer reading list for our final episode of the summer, the week after next. So if you've read anything good recently, by a European writer or set somewhere in Europe, tell me and I will add it to the list. You can tweet at us at EuropeansPod, DM us on Instagram, EuropeansPodcast, or send us a good old-fashioned email, hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Thanks to our producers, my co-host Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak, who worked on this episode. Kat Slazo is the other producer on this team working on some longer-term projects. We are members of the Are We Europe audio family. Head to areweeurope.eu/audio-family to hear more of their audio offerings.
See you next week, everyone.
Goulet, goulet.
Bye.